Welcome to Doctor's Orders with your host, Dr. Baker. Now let's join today's program.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon on this really quite dreary and almost rainy, but not quite, Market Monday. Here in Cincinnati, I am your host, Dr. Baker. I am the owner of the Business Hospital, the only business hospital in the world servicing 14 countries. And I only tell you that because it is my only job when I wake up from a work standpoint is to make sure that your businesses are healthy and that you understand how to operate your businesses at an efficient level and to give you ideas about just the world from a business perspective. I've got a really wonderful guest today that I'm going to bring on in a moment to talk about some things that may feel and seem a little non-traditional in nature, but you'll definitely see the connection as I'm really excited about the work that he does with his organizations. But today, if you want to join our conversation at any time, you can do so by calling in at 859-291-2255. That's 859-291-2255. And if you want to send me a note personally and I will respond back to you, you can do so at info@drbaker.us. Once again, that is info@drbaker.us. And if any of you have been listening to the show for any time, you know that every day is a different segment. And so with it being Market Monday, I'm liable to cover anything. If it's in a market, we're going to cover it. So it could be traditional marketing, which a lot of people always need assistance with. And we've been able to bring you experts to talk about marketing initiatives. But ultimately, it's about looking at different markets. And that's just another way of saying industries and what's going on in the world around us. How do we view our world? And then how do we take what we've heard, learned, experienced, and have seen and leverage that to enhance our businesses? If you're a small business, you know that we categorize small business here on the show as $50 million and under, 500 employees or less. And so that includes all of your startup founders, your mom and pop shops, micro and boutique businesses, legacy and family-owned businesses. All of those things are considered small business. And so, therefore, it's my job to make sure that I'm helping you in any way that I possibly can. My guest today is Carlton Collins, and this is a person that I've come to know for a long time. And his hands are involved in so many wonderful different organizations within the city, and I'm personally excited about talking about a few of them. I've come, gotten wind of a few initiatives that they put on that I just really want to talk about and bring to everyone's attention. So it's certainly a business or an organization that I would like to highlight. So Carlton Collins, thanks so much for taking the time to join the show. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Really appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. And so just for a reference point for all of our listeners, walk us through, the organizations that you work with and what your title is and essentially what those organizations do.
All right. Well, first and foremost, in terms of my day job, I am the program manager for Leading Men Fellowship Cincinnati. The parent company is the Literacy Lab, which was started in D.C. in 2009, and Leading Men Fellowship was started in 2016 in D.C. as well. But the goal of Leading Men is to work with 18 to 24-year-old men of color and place them in preschools as literacy coaches. So they'll be working in preschools throughout Cincinnati. Our core partners are Cincinnati Public Schools and Learning Grove currently. But they're working with three to four-year-olds. They're placed in a single classroom for the entire year, working schedule from 8 to 2. The pay is $16.50 an hour, as well as a travel and communication stipend each month, and $2,500 that goes towards an education award for continuing education when they finish their fellowship year. We just got back from Atlanta, had a great time at Ascend Institute. So they brought all of us together, the new regions and existing regions. So Cincinnati is part of the new regions, Cincinnati, Atlanta, and Phoenix, were those, and, Milwaukee, Baltimore, DC, and in Richmond, Portsmouth, Virginia area were the existing regions. But we all communed in Atlanta, had the opportunity for training. And the fellows go into classrooms this week. They start this Wednesday in classrooms around Cincinnati. So that's the day job. Just get the incredible experience of working with young men, helping them develop as both professionals in the field of education, but also grow as men, and just helping them just walk a straight path and see education as a true opportunity for career advancement.
Well, you know what? I want to pause there for a moment before we transition into the next work that you do, because this role that was created, or really this organization that was established in D.C. in 2009, really had to have a good vision of how they wanted to roll this out for the nation and how they would program specifically to say, how are we going to take a group of individuals and then massage that effort in order to determine how do we get a yield from that long term. And so I actually saw some of these young men literally, you know, at the airport as you guys were traveling, and I could see the enthusiasm. I heard about what you guys did, the experiences you gave. Talk to me a little bit, or really talk to the audience a little bit, about an organization like this, the mission, the vision, and then what are the fruits that the company is looking to see or yield from this?
Absolutely. There was a lot of vision that went into it. I would say the organization is definitely in a transition period. This is kind of getting into, you know, Literacy Lab 2.0, where there's more reach, more expanded impact. But I think at the core, the root of it to start with was twofold, right? How do we impact, you know, our most vulnerable learners, which early learners are? They're sponges. They can soak up a lot, right? They also can miss a lot. And how do we put more intentionality on their outcomes? So we implement a model called SEEDS, which is big around social-emotional learning, but also having empathy in the classroom, understanding what's going on with the learner. So it's very much so a learner-centered curriculum. But the fellows who are not licensed teachers, actually you can't be, if you've graduated from a four-year institution, we actually don't accept you as a fellow. Right? Mm. We're on the ground floor specifically to try to identify young men in this age range, in 18 to 24, if you're a man of color, at least for me, it's a very dangerous time, right? Where any missteps could change the trajectory of your life. So it's impacting the young learners, but then also creating a pipeline to improve minority education. The book that I read, I was handed when I was 18 years old, was Countering the Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys, by Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu, as well as Black Student Middle Class Teacher by Dr. Kanjufu as well. And those two books are the two books that really got me in education. But one talked about the lack of male teachers, particularly Black male teachers, in preschool and kindergarten, those early childhood years. But the entire teaching population, Black males represent less than 2%. And it's been that way in the 15 years I've been trying to get more Black men into classrooms. And the other side of it, in terms of Black student middle class teacher, is the reality that you have a lot of teachers who grow up in predominantly white communities, go then to predominantly white institutions or PWIs, and then they're dropped into the inner city, and then they're culturally expected to understand the pupils that are in front of them, right? And then that creates division, which increases, you know, discipline referrals for particularly Black boys and Black men, as well as special education referrals. Right. Some of those trends and all of those things are still very much active stats. So those are the main things. Right. How do we create a pipeline of minority educators, give some career access, professional development to these young men, and have positive impact on early learners all simultaneously?
Talk to me a little bit about the company structure, because when you're looking to embark on a mission such as the one that you all are looking into. It's obviously deep-rooted. There's many complexities at play as it relates to how to set the structure up, how to execute the plan. Is this a nonprofit or is it a for-purpose company?
Oh, it's nonprofit for sure. Always has operated as from a nonprofit perspective, but there's a lot of partnership that goes on with private philanthropy, as well as school districts, so departments of education, and dollars that come from city and state funds. So it's definitely a cross section of how the organization is funded. I think when we'll be all in cost, right, is about $50,000 per fellow. That includes staff, that includes support materials, all those things. That's pretty much what the cost comes up to be.
Now, when you're talking nonprofit organization, you know, a lot of people come to me regularly. Hey, Dr. Baker, I'd like to start a nonprofit. Hey, Dr. Baker, can you assist us with growing the nonprofit? What do you contribute some of the growth patterns that you guys have experienced since existing since 2009? Is there anything that you can speak to particularly?
I would say understanding when the landscape is right, right? Not necessarily rushing into, and I think that's what the organization has done and done a fairly good job of doing, right? So we got to Cincinnati and we got to Atlanta through the due diligence, essentially, of Greenlight Fund. And just the realities of that are that there were people who were kind of making sure that a new program in a new city would land on fertile ground, right? Mm-hmm. So I think one of the key things that I would tell anybody who's interested in the nonprofit space, right, and this is also just coming from, you know, I've been in this nonprofit management space for a number of years myself. I was still in college. I think I was probably 20 when I really dove into this world of grant writing and all those kinds of things. I would say make sure that you are very deliberate about the impact that you can make, and then ask yourself the honest question, is there somebody else doing it, and is there an opportunity to collaborate with the absence of ego, right? Because a lot of people want their name on things, and that is the number one reason that they do it. They're not the most qualified to do it. They don't have the best plan or action steps laid out. And in actuality, by serving under someone else, helping them grow and expand, there may be room for your vision within that, right?
And then I think you make a really good point that I want to spend some time on, is understanding where you are in time and place, understanding how to serve, especially if you're in the nonprofit world, and what the servitude look like. And you also mentioned something else about having your name on something. As I've seen, you know, businesses break apart because partners, groups, boards have had issues with who's getting the credit, how is information being pushed, and who's responsible for it, and where does it ultimately come from. And I've seen that those things, those realities have torn up organizations. And so it sounds like that you've seen those realities firsthand, and that you're actually warning against that. Conversely, it also seems as if, you know, the organization that you guys are doing there with, you know, Leading Men Fellowship of Cincinnati, that you guys haven't had those same issues, and that you guys do come with a behavior of servitude. And how can you help push the agenda forward, because you all kind of see the mission and you feel the mission, and therefore you're connected to the mission. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that was the thing for me, right? Even getting into this role, taking on this challenge, you know, my number one goal was, how do I change the lives of 20 young men, right? So, like, let's start there. Let's, you know, just like I said we have a very learner-centered kind of curriculum, really thinking of it from the perspective of how do I be fellow-centered in terms of the operations of our office. Because I think a lot of people are looking at the exterior and not the interior. And the interior is dealing with impact, right? The interior is dealing with the transitions that the people you're charged to serve make, the transformations that they're able to realize. And I think that gets lost sometimes, right, in the management of a nonprofit, the management of some kind of public service that you're trying to do. Oftentimes, the very people that you are trying to serve are not served to their best best capability, because we get lost in terms of, you know, arguing over small things, or in the way Jay-Z puts it, the shiny things.
Well, you got to stay away from that because there's cancers that pop up everywhere, and ultimately, you want to keep the mind of the mission at the forefront. You want your board to mimic that same behavior, and you want the employees, the staff, the membership, the donors, you want the entire stakeholder group to mimic that same behavior. Can you speak to how you guys have been able to build a community that allows you to move the mission forward?
So actually this is like a perfect moment, right? To introduce the second half of what I do in this space, because I think it's a very interesting proposition, and I would love to have this conversation with you.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the other roles that I take is as director of programs and special projects for the Heights Movement. So the Heights Movement, 501c3 organization based serving the residents of Lincoln Heights. We have four pillars. We focus on beautification and social justice. So in that space is where our murals take place, as well as our advocacy to remove the Cincinnati Police Department gun range. That is, there's 38,000 gun training hours that take place at this open-air facility. Cincinnati Police Department, Evendale Police, FBI, DEA, ATF, U.S. Marshals all use this facility. They shoot 300 days a year, 6 days a week, 7 hours a day. They've done so for 75 years. We've been advocating for its removal since August of 2019. Good news to report is that we've been able to lobby and push for the raising of $11 million so far. Just got $4 million from the Senate, thanks to Senator Sherrod Brown, $5 million from the county. Shout out to Commissioner Denise Driehaus and team, and then another $2 million from the city in their budget to try to move this range. So hopefully we'll get it done in the next 6 months or so. It'll be shut down, and they'll be moving to Coleraine Township. But then we also have education and workforce development pillar where we focus on big picture. It's my brother's keeper, Lincoln Heights. So we work in conjunction with the Obama Foundation, working to support black and brown males. But we extend those services out and the work that we do out across genders. And then we have a resident empowerment program, which falls under our economic empowerment pillar, where we've had the fortunate opportunity to put dollars in the pockets of residents. Serve as supplemental income. And then we've also converted a church right on Adams Street in Lincoln Heights into an innovation center. So just a space where folks can learn, co-working space, all those kinds of things. And a stock and finance room, have a multimedia room. Shout out to Easily Blessed Media. And then public service, right? So in terms of dealing with the gun range, you know, how are we establishing a continuum of healing around the entire community? We deal with toxic stress and ACEs, which is adverse childhood experiences, working on a community needs assessment with Interact for Health, and a number of other things. So that's the Heights Movement. It's this big, massive organization. We do a lot of work in terms of our core team. But the interesting thing about it, and this is where, you know, your dissection comes into play, or we can have a great conversation, is we don't have any full-time employees.
Mm-hmm. Which makes that tough.
It makes it very tough, but we've had a fortunate opportunity, you know, post the murder of George Floyd, to work with our corporations, right? And it started with GE Aviation, got access to their employees. And one of the first things that we asked for is for them to teach us project management for ourselves as well as for the council members of the Village of Lincoln Heights. And it went from there. Then we got adopted by Leadership Class 44. Then we were adopted by I Am My Brother's Keeper, the employee resource group for black males out of Procter & Gamble. So we wouldn't be here today without our corporate volunteers that helped us on, you know, one-day type projects, but also helped us in the back office, right, of helping us structure and create systems that can be duplicable. So there's been an incredible, I guess, kind of ecosystem or science created to what we're doing with the Heights Movement. But we've worked with over 50 partners so far in the last couple of years.
Well, you know, I want to talk about a few aspects that you brought up, and you just talked about working with over 50 partners. I actually want to talk about that. Strategic partnership is something that I speak with all of my patients about, and who are they providing service to or with that they can provide value to, and who has a vested interest in their growth. And that's how I term a strategic partner. Many businesses, nonprofit organizations, and entities alike skip this stage from a direct or an intentional standpoint. I would say that nonprofits are the best at it based on my experiences. Other small businesses neglect these elements, but it seems as if you guys have done a really good job at, number one, creating targets that would become strategic partners, and then two, executing and converting on those relationships. Talk to us a little bit about what I would call the strategy as to how you all know who's a good partner, and then how do you create the dialogue to bring them into the things that you're doing, because it's not so much just about what you're doing, it's also about aligning a vision for you to provide value back to them as well. And how do you guys navigate that discussion?
No, great question. I would say the first thing is that it starts with a cause, right? Being very clear and succinct. I think the argument, you know, from a corporate partnership perspective, a lot took off after our protest on Juneteenth of 2020. And that protest led to opening the conversation, right? So I think the first thing, by having your cause very, very clearly defined, and that by that point we had demands of what we wanted from the removal of the gun range and all of those kinds of things, and it was a huge focus on adverse childhood experiences and how are we creating healing for the damage that has been caused, right, intergenerationally. So I think us being very, very clear and focused there opened the door for us, right, to then figure out and put in a request for anybody who was interested in actually learning about the history of the Village of Lincoln Heights, right, and particularly in relation to GE Aviation, right? For those that don't know, GE Aviation sits on land that once was had black residents of Lincoln Heights on it, like living there. Lincoln Heights, if you see it on a map, it's cut out and it looks like a tea kettle, but it was shaped in that way, which was 10% of the original incorporation, but it was also where it cut out the industrial tax base all around it. So that's on the Lachlan side, Woodlawn side, and Evendale. And with that being the case, right, I think a fallacy that a lot of people run into is that they believe, they look at corporations through the lens of a broad brush.
Mm-hmm.
And the corporation itself, the corporation is one thing. The corporation's employees are another thing. And we took the route of focusing on the corporation employees, and it was an intentional focus, not about treasure, which everybody thinks about in the nonprofit space, but it was a intentional focus and ask around time and talent before we get to treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to give, you know, a huge shout out to Joanne Sawyer. She was our, we call her our sensei. But she made it, she got us to buy into that concept, right? Let the employees show up. Let the employees get invested. Let the employees set up subcommittees that help advance certain areas and things that need to get done on behalf of the village. And then we kind of took it from there. You know, once we had a few people's buy-in, then it was, okay, how can we rack up wins, right? How can we, what do we need to do to get this produce market off the ground, which now we're in year two of operation, and we're almost done. We got almost all the pavers down. With the pavers and the picnic tables, and we got a fireplace out there. And these are all things that were later funded by GE, right?
Mm-hmm.
They helped us to do it, as well as Center for Closing the Health Gap, because Lincoln Heights is also a food desert. So we just wanted to provide more access to fresh produce. But that turned into them getting vested in the process, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we identified, again, goes back to that cause. The cause is we have food deserts. We don't have any grocery stores in the Heights. All we have is corner stores. Can we grow enough produce to put it in corner stores where then it just becomes a revenue stream for both the business and for the Heights movement, right? So what we always say is don't ask people what they like to do. Ask them what problems that they can solve, and then we can put you in the best position to get it done, you know, alongside our corporate partners. And that's kind of the approach that we take as we, you know, work to establish change for our community.
Well, it looks like those corporate partners have had the ability to catapult the organization forward. It made very timely connections. And when I'm saying timely, sometimes it's access, sometimes it's resources, sometimes it's actual money, sometimes it's information. Mm-hmm. I imagine that all of your partners in some form or fashion have brought those resources to you that you all could leverage in order to grow the organization into the way that it is today.
Absolutely, 100% right.
You know, and as you're out there and you're taking a look at, you know, who could benefit from the solutions that we're providing, that becomes really careful to say who has a vested interest in the things that we're connected to, carving that list out appropriately, and then having the right message lines. And one thing that I find unique about business owners is that we look at the world based on our ability to survive, essentially meaning, I have a product, I have a service, I have a mission. Everyone should like it because I like it. And that's not necessarily the case. It's more about finding what it is that another entity needs assistance with and how the synergy between the two best benefits both of you. So it's looking at your organization or your company differently in order for you to have the right match with that partner. Is that the way that you all see it as well?
Absolutely. And so much so that it became, right, we took our partners, and it kind of naturally happened, but there were so many partners that were working and helping on the behalf of the Heights movement that it almost, for us, we were like, okay, so how could we expand this out to other community partners, right? So we created a round table with corporate partners, different folks who want to, whether they have jobs, whether they are providing a different resource, like a people working cooperatively and providing jobs like a Messer Construction or Pepper Construction or Pepsi, right? Because we've had career fairs and we've had mental health first aid certification days, to get more adults certified to where they can identify a child in distress, right? So I think a lot of it is just knowing where to find, when you've identified your problem so succinctly and you have a very clear way that you can communicate that and clear outcomes that you're looking to secure, right? Then it's about finding the funding opportunities that exist and creating the strategic partnerships that will help drive those outcomes. And it's, and I think one of the key things that is part of the process is being able to speak the language of whomever you're going to serve, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't speak to Ernst & Young, this accounting firm. Don't speak to them in a language that works for a retailer, like you're speaking to Kroger or Target, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the things that you're asking them for, making sure that it's commensurate with the skill sets that you find among the employees.
Mm-hmm.
Because you may be speaking to a particular department inside of that corporation. That particular department might have some specific strategic, you know, skill set that can help move your nonprofit forward. You just have to have the foresight to not just ask for something that's topical, not just ask for something that's one day, but asking, you know, just a few people to commit solid time with the amount of expertise that they have to put your organization in the position to where it's now visibly advancing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, right, as a nonprofit leader, I think looking at it from the perspective of getting outside of the box of how people can contribute to your organization, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people only think about the board, but there's been a lot of people who volunteered for 3 months, right, in biweekly meetings, so 6 sessions that have done more than people that sit on our board.
Mm-hmm.
So imagining, I think you have to get creative around the strategy that you have and the places that you want to go. And frankly, I think one of the only places that a business plan is just outside of if you're looking for funding, right? That a business plan is absolutely critical. I would say a business plan is more critical for a nonprofit than it is for a for-profit company right now.
You know what? I want to talk about that because that leads into another question that I wanted to pose to you. I need to take a break for a station identification. And everyone that's listening today, you guys are listening to Doctor's Orders. This is Market Monday. And today's Market Monday is brought to you by Bazemore Beard Oil. That's BAZEMORE, Bazemore Beard Oil. If you want a better beard, a more quality beard, thicker beard, better smelling beard, you can do so with Bazemore Beard Oil. It can be found at BazemoreProducts.com. There are 3 fragrances, which are Flight, Nova, and Waves. They can come in individual packs or they come in a combo pack that allows you to sample all 3. Try it today if you want a better quality beard. Bazemore Beard Oil is the beard oil for you. And today's guest is Carlton Collins. He is representing Leading Men Fellowship of Cincinnati along with the Heights Movement. And we're talking all things nonprofit organization, mission-based operations, how to understand, how to connect with strategic partners, all the things that you need to understand in the event that you're in the nonprofit space, the for-purpose space, or if you're looking to execute sponsors and or fundraising, this is the conversation you need to listen to. If you want to join the conversation, you can at 859-291-2255. Once again, that is 859-291-2255. And if you want to send me a message directly, you can at info@drbaker.us. So, Carlton, you were just talking about a business plan and how important business planning is in the world of the nonprofit space, even in comparison to the traditional small business space. So So go ahead and kind of let the listeners know what your opinion is on the business plan and why it's so needed in this element. And so I'm not sure if Carlton went on mute there. Carlton, are you with us?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was on mute. I was just talking away.
Yep, go ahead.
No, so I was saying the landscape is rapidly changing in the for-profit space, right? And it's really, you have to be nimble. I say that you should be reevaluating and adjusting your business planning on a quarterly basis from a for-profit perspective. The two things that I always say from a innovation and, you know, nimbleness, right, from an industry perspective, the two things that just don't have that are education and in the nonprofit space.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some things changing, but there aren't, they're not changing so fast. It usually takes years for there to be seismic shifts, right? So from that perspective, your business plan lasts longer for a nonprofit organization.
Mm-hmm.
But most importantly, and this is, you know, we were going to have these conversations, and RIP Kobe, we had an incredible opportunity to start looking at the intersection between for-profits and nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
And someday, hopefully, we still get a chance to do that conference or seminar or something. You know what I mean?
Agreed. And just to put some color to that is that we were looking to put on a conference right during really the time of COVID, right before mm-hmm. there. And we had Kobe Bryant as our guest speaker, in which we had reached out to him and his team. And he had passed right during those conversations. And so we had to pivot, and then we were going to bring Urban Meyer in to stand in for him. But then COVID hit, and we were unable to do any of it. And so we need to revisit what does that look like in order to help nonprofits and business owners really elevate their game, if you will, in their spaces.
Absolutely. And the crux of that conversation was, hey, nonprofits need to have revenue streams. And for-profits need to have causes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because in the world of philanthropy, having clearly defined revenue streams and other ways that you will consistently make money as a nonprofit organization only encourages funders to spend dollars with you. And the more the more diversified your revenue streams are as a nonprofit organization, it just improves your profile as somebody who not only who's not overly dependent on a singular large scale donor. So being able to diversify yourself, whether that be programming, I think you still have to look at your nonprofit organization and still understand what are the profit centers for your, for the organization, right? What are the things that are going to drive, whether it's grant dollars, philanthropic dollars, you can tell stories about, right? You can tell stories of your innovation, but tell stories of your impact, right? All of those are critically important. To understand what are the drivers, you know, what are the causes that you're focused on, and what are the stories of impact that you can tell that will lead you down a road to, you know, becoming the leader in your space, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or becoming a leader in your space. And I think that's really, really important on the nonprofit side. I think people think not making money when they think about nonprofits. And it's the most backwards thought process ever. Nonprofits, like, you're allowed to pay yourself for your nonprofit. We just don't have any full-time employees because we decided, we made the choice to put the residents first. right?
Well, you know, I was going to jump into that and thinking about, since you don't have any full time, you know, you've got volunteers then, or you have part-timers that have taken on, you know, the charge to say, you know, we're going to push this organization forward. How do you all deal with time commitment, loyalty, obligation, responsibility, roles, and distribution, delegation? What does that look like through your human capital management?
So for us, when it comes to, so there's several areas. One, in terms of the corporate volunteers, they're already ready. They already operate with maximum efficiency because GE Aviation does.
Mm-hmm.
Or it wouldn't be a multinational billion-dollar corporation. Procter & Gamble already does. We don't have to teach them that. For those who came through Fifth Third, for those who came through Truist Bank or First Financial or any number of the other corporations that we've worked with, right? They're already prepared. They're already seasoned professionals. So the I think the key is to not ask them to do anything outside of their comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
They manage projects and they're a part of teams all day, every day. So that part is natural. The beautiful part of it is that they're still being paid by their corporation to still help you to meet during the day if they could fit it in, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually part of their charge as employees, is to do some version of community work. So that's the first part, right? Trust them to be professionals. The second part of it is self-development, right? Us, we wouldn't be here today without the project management support that we got from GE Aviation. Shout out to Marvin Francis, who's one of the senior project managers within GE. But he taught us a course over 6 weeks, and we met every week. And we went through a project charter. This is what it is. This is why we're doing it. And this is the information that we got to pull out to make sure that we're, you know, building every project the right way. And from that training, our team got astronomically better at executing in meetings and having follow-ups and having key points that we're trying to hit towards and setting deadlines and managing a lot of those smaller and finite details, right? So we start with a project charter. So the tools that you personally are equipped with and getting everybody else to buy into is critically important to your success. And then the third thing is for the people who aren't polished, right? The other side of the coin from these corporate professionals, I mean, you have residents and folks that are in the community who just want to support. The transparency, right, of the project and of the action steps that need to be taken, giving people very clear and finite steps, not asking people to do the thinking, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's not a visionary. Everybody does not want to get into the weeds of your organization.
Mm-hmm.
What they want to do is they want to commit themselves to completing a task on your behalf, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have to make that finite. It has a very clear start and a very clear end. And then once you can create these descriptions of what volunteers need to be able to do or what they can help you with or what they can sign up for, you know, then it's just a matter of pushing them out to a number of different stakeholders. So I think those are the three big things in terms of management. And then whoever your executive team is, they just got to be locked in.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can't, our organization would not work if we weren't semi-autonomous, right? Each of us has our lane. We control our lane. We execute in our lane. And we have a very clear understanding of how we're supposed to treat and operate among our partners and with our partners. And a lot of things people think are like, people are like, wow, we don't know how you do it all. It's because we don't. We each have our lane. Like, and we operate in our space. And there's times where we're telling folks on a call about something, and us on the team are learning about it the first time because it just happened in real time, right? But we just roll with the punches, right? And you just got to stay flexible. And don't get down on your teammates. Because if you have an expectation of perfection from people who are serving in a volunteer capacity, you're immediately sowing distrust into your organization.
How frequently do you see that? You know, we operate in the United States where, and I think there's a shift in mentality based on a host of varying perspectives that it just exists now within our culture. But, you know, the United States have always been a bottom line place. You know, either you did or you didn't, either you won or you lost, either it made money or it didn't. What does that look like in your space? I know what traditional nonprofits organizations foster, and a lot of times it is about the mission, but you can certainly find that type of what I'm going to term as cancerous behavior, even amongst volunteers. What does that look like, you know, with the work that you all do along with the audience that you serve?
It looks like grace. That's the first thing. It looks like grace. Like, so there's two things that I always teach, one of which is you're never responsible for how other people deal with facts. That's not your job. Like, you're not supposed to be policing or investing energies into things that don't yield positive outcomes, right? So you keep the energy flowing in one direction, and that's towards what are our goals. So I think that's the first and foremost. There's a lot of times where you have to turn the other cheek, and because you're turning the cheek not for who you are. I would never turn the cheek as Carlton, ever. But turning the cheek for the Heights movement, I've done more times than I'm willing to admit. Right? Because the business entity is not based off of emotion. The business entity is not based off feeling. You can't operate in that space. Regardless of how strong the feelings are, you still have an incredible responsibility to the people that you serve. And that's more important than how you feel in the moment. So I think the number one thing is grace. Now, that doesn't mean they get to stay, right? For anybody who hasn't seen it, I strongly recommend for people to check out the sermon called Road Rage by T.D. Jakes.
Absolutely love it.
But one of the things that he said is that, you know, you can't have die vision. It's two visions. You have a vision that you already have, right? Or that volunteer has a vision for the way things are supposed to work. But if that is conflicting with the vision that you have for the organization, and most importantly, the work that has been put in, right? If there's no respect for the work that has already been done, then it's okay for them to then be separated from the organization and the mission and the vision that you have already.
Well, is that a function of, now, do you consider that as a function of communication? Do you have that as a function of intent? You know, what do you attribute any philosophical mismatches between the organization, volunteers, and the ultimate mission?
I don't try to give them attributes. Right? I'm only focused on the outcome. And if you're fighting, because we deal with this on a regular basis, and we've dealt with this candidly, just in terms of our overarching relationship with the Village of Lincoln Heights. And there's some gray area in it because one of our core executive members, his name is Durant, is Councilman Durant Daniels. But we've had to turn the cheek on a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But then the thing that makes it problematic, but also not worth our energy, is the fact that you can't justify standing in our way when our goal is to help kids.
Understood.
Right? So from that perspective, you think about it from, you always have to be in this mode of self-reflection, I think is first.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You always, even when something goes wrong, you still have to analyze yourself first. And it can't be, oh, you did this to me. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I want to take the perspective of understanding what we could have done better, if that means communication, if that means transparency, if that means creating more opportunities for fellowship or potential partnership, right?
Mm-hmm.
We hold those responsibilities and put that responsibility on ourselves first before we ever deal with or address how they behaved, right, or anybody behaved. And I think that's part of the process in terms of understanding it from a grace perspective. But I think doing so is always being in the mindset of being reconciliatory, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think because our goal is for all of Lincoln Heights and every entity within Lincoln Heights to thrive, and if we can be connections to help support that, help them in the process of thriving, by all means, that's what we want to do. So if that's mm-hmm. our goal, our actions will just simply speak for themselves. And if there's anything contrary to that, then when the time comes and folks get and all the details get to the carpet, I think we'll be able to, because of our track record, and we just work through it. Every obstacle, we work through it.
Now, you talked about a behavior, and you talked about obstacles. Well, one obstacle that I know exists for all companies is an infusion of cash. Whether it's fundraising, debt financing, investor relationships, that becomes a thorn in the side for pretty much every company I've ever seen at some level. So what is the behavior, you know, of your organizations and how you all see fundraising? Is it a constant daily reality? Is it a cyclical? How do you guys handle that?
I would probably say we try to deal with it. Obviously, things that have immediacy, we deal with immediately. But by and large, I think we try to always stay a quarter ahead in terms of what we're looking at,
mm-hmm.
right? And then who are the partners that need to be engaged? And I think it's the same for both, you know, Leading Men Fellowship and for the Heights Movement. It's identifying the strategic opportunities that exist, and then who are the people who should be at the table to win from those opportunities, right? So with Leading Men Fellowship, I bring up in the spring, well, actually, you know, February, so Black History Month, towards the end, we're going to have something called Leading Men Summit. Reality is that Cincinnati doesn't have a Black Male Achievement Network or Achievement Network for Men of Color, so why not put that together, right? Why
mm-hmm.
not create a space for us to share best practices and resource share and all of those things? And, you know, one of the ultimate goals to come out of that convening is, what would it look like to create a fund that supports organizations that are Black and brown male-led, as well as organizations that are serving Black and brown males and actually producing tangible outcomes for them? What would it look like for a fund to exist for the city as a whole to support those initiatives and those organizations?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, my man Lawrence Kane says this all the time. Collaboration is always better than competition. So I think that's a major part for us is, we've been conveners, so it's given us more opportunity to better opportunities to fundraise.
Mm-hmm.
and to create platforms that make incredible sense for us in terms of big picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that's most important in that is, as long as you have the vision set and the vision is cast forward of where you're trying to go and what you're trying to get to,
mm-hmm.
A lot of the small stuff that happens in between, you look at them as speed bumps, right? And it's not that 10-foot fence in front of you.
Right.
Where you're going, you're approaching it from the perspective. When you got the vision set, you're approaching it from the perspective of, I know this is something that I will get over, right? Because a car is meant to get over a speed bump.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You see that 10-foot fence and you're like, I don't know if I can climb it. You start doubting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But if the vision's long enough, the vision's forward enough, you'll be in position and you'll have the confidence to believe that, you know, this too shall pass.
Which I think is really strong. You know, you guys have started something and then it's been built on, and you guys are building this throughout the nation. Hence the reason why you guys just came off of a great trip with some wonderful young men, giving them experiences that they had not had before. If anyone wants to contact either organization, how can they do so, Carlton?
I can be reached at ccollins@theliteracylab.org. And everything is at the Literacy Lab in terms of social media and all of those things. And then you can also find us at the Heights Movement on social media. And I am Carlton, C-A-R-L-T-O-N, @theheightsmovement.org. That's my email. But anything anybody is interested in, by all means, I'm here. I also do minority business development. I also have an education consultancy. There's a couple other companies that I work with. I don't slow down. I got 3 kids, a high schooler, 3 and 1, and then a wife. So my life is always full. It's an adventure every single day. I actually have a cousin whose water broke while we were on this phone.
Oh, wow. So you guys' family continue to grow, continue to get bigger, and I know you're getting pulled in all the directions. You know, one thing that I can attest to is that wherever the work is, you tend to show up and you don't run away from it. And so when you're a business owner, that's pretty much how your life is that whether you're an owner or whether you're a director of a business that's looking to expand, looking to scale, is that you can't run away from the work. You know, I always find it very comical when someone says that they like to create a business because they don't like, you know, maybe the hours at their current job, or, you know, maybe they don't like their boss, or they're going to like their new boss less. Because if you're a good boss of a business, then that means that you're beating yourself up because of how much there is to do. There is a way to do it in balance, but the sacrifice is large, especially from the onset. You know, Carlton, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today, allowing us to learn more about the organizations. I think that the work that Leading Men Fellowship of Cincinnati and the Heights Movement is just absolutely remarkable. I want you guys to continue to do the great work. For those out there that are listening today, thanks a lot for taking the time to do so. Hopefully, we've been able to give you some ideas on what it looks like in the nonprofit space, whether it's having a mentality of fundraising, whether it's carving out your strategic partners in a way that's going to help you grow, and then ultimately providing grace to those that are helping your mission move along forward, which were great tips from Carlton Collins himself. Everyone, thanks so much for tuning in today. Tomorrow is Tech Tuesday. Look forward to seeing you then. Have a great one.
Thank you for joining us for Doctor's Orders. You can contact Dr. Baker by phone at 1-855-249-4677, by email at info@drbaker.us. You can learn more on our website at www.drbaker.us. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. right here on 1320 AM, 103.9 FM, and on www.1320thevoice.com.